dismembered and badly decomposed relics. The difficulty faced by medical investigators can be seen in the deposition of Dr. Franklin T. Wilcox of LaPorte, brought in by Coroner Mack to conduct the autopsy on the adult female. With the exception of the uterus, none of the viscera could be recognized. The right arm was severed by a chopping instrument an inch below the head of the humerus. Both arms were detached from the body. The two femora were cut off through the lower third. There were found four arms and four forearms with hands with the body, but it is impossible to say which, if any, belonged to this body. There were found two skulls and two lower maxillary bones with this body, but it is impossible to say which, if any, belonged to this body. There were also two sets of fibula, but they could not be positively identified as belonging to this body. From the examination, it is impossible to determine the cause of death. Though in equally appalling condition, the remains of the younger female did retain one distinguishing feature, a matted tress of long blonde hair sprouting from the fleshless skull. From this unmistakable evidence, witnesses who knew her in life were able to positively identify the butchered young woman. Jenny Olson had not been sent away to a seminary in California 2 years earlier. She had not gotten married and was not on her honeymoon journey. Chopped into a half-dozen pieces, she had been dumped into a corpse-filled hole and covered with rubbish in her foster mother's hog pen. And, as newspapers around the nation would soon report, the date on which her butchered remains were brought to light, May 5, 1908, would have been her 18th birthday. 16. Murderess. There had, of course, been notorious murders in Indiana before. Perhaps the most sensational was the 1895 case of Reverend William E. Hinshaw. A much-admired figure in the village of Belleville, Hinshaw was accused of killing his wife, Thirza, who had discovered his affair with a pretty young parishioner, then inflicting nearly 20 flesh wounds on himself with pistol and razor, and claiming that he had sustained the injuries while grappling heroically with a pair of intruders who had snuck into his bedroom at night and murdered his wife. His trial in September of that year, which climaxed with his conviction, became a courtroom sensation, the one absorbing topic of public interest for its 2 month duration. For all the titillated fascination it generated, however, the Belleville tragedy, as it became known, remained a local story, little known beyond the Hoosier State. By contrast, the Ganesse case would be front page news throughout the country and even overseas. Big-time newspaper men from all over converged on LaPorte, writes one historian of the crime. 7 Chicago papers had a total of 22 reporters on the ground. Others arrived from New York, St. Louis, Detroit. There were 35 in all. They set up headquarters at the Hotel Tea Garden. In 10 days, they would put out an estimated 1 million words of sensational copy. Overnight, Belle Ganesse, formerly lauded in the press for her heroic but futile effort to save her offspring, was transformed into a demon. In its earliest report on the gruesome discoveries of May 5th, the Chicago American, within the space of a few paragraphs, branded her as both the most fiendish murderer of the age and the most fiendish murderess in history. The same paper was also the first to raise a possibility that would haunt the case forever. Given her diabolical cunning, it now seemed conceivable that the headless body found in the ruins of the cellar was not Belle Ganesse at all, but another of her victims, whose decapitated corpse had been substituted for the arch-murderess. Mrs. Ganesse, the paper declared, was now thought to be still alive. Ray Lamphere was reading his Bible and chewing meditatively on a wad of tobacco when Sheriff Smutzer returned from the Ganesse farm and informed him of the day's horrific developments. "My God," gasped Lamphere. "5 bodies. I knew that woman was bad, but nothing like this." Led from his cell, he was brought before a group of reporters who peppered him with questions about the unearthed corpses. He insisted he knew nothing about it, though he admitted that he had harbored some suspicions. "There were things I noticed," he said. "I guess they were more serious than I thought." Asked to elaborate, he told of the time, immediately after Helgeline's arrival, that Mrs. Ganesse instructed him to go to town and buy a container of rough-on rats, a popular pesticide compounded of 10% soot and 90% arsenic. Another time she wanted chloroform, Lamphere said. Anything else? One of the reporters pressed. Well, about a year ago, said Ray, there was a man with a black mustache who came to the farm, and Mrs. Ganesh told me he was a friend of Jenny's. He had a big trunk with him. A long while after he went away, the trunk was still at the house. It used to stand upstairs. It still had the man's clothes in it, which seemed to me kind of funny. Speaking of Jenny, did Lamphere think the dead girl dug up that afternoon might be her? Someone asked. Lamphere nodded gravely. It must be Jenny, he said. I never believed she was in California. I never heard of any letters coming from her. Before being taken back to his cell, Lamphere was asked again about Andrew Helgeline. Look here, he answered. I don't know anything about that, and I don't know anything about the fire except what I told a long time ago. She used to tell me not to talk to Helgeline. One time she found us together in the sitting room when she came in. She was angry and told me to get out and never speak to him again. I told her I'd speak to him if I felt like it. Well, a few days later I came home from town and Helgeline was gone. I asked about him and she said, I told you you'd never talk to him again. I didn't know what she meant, Lamphere said, as Smutzer took him by the arm and led him away. But now I understand. That same day, a letter arrived at the LaPorte post office addressed to Mrs. Ganesh. Like all her mail since the fire, it was handed over to Wesley Fogle, a local implement dealer, appointed by Bell as her executor. The letter was from a Waupaca, Wisconsin man named Carl Peterson, writing to say that he was sorry he could not meet Mrs. Ganesh's requirements as to his financial condition, but assuring her that he was respectable and worthy in every way. Tracked down by reporters, Peterson explained that he had initially contacted Bell after seeing her ad in the Scandinavian. In her response, which he had received just the previous week, she had described her farm in glowing terms and explained that she was looking for a man to share it with. She was perfectly willing to consider Peterson as a partner, as long as he was able to put up $1,000 cash. If not, there was no point in pursuing the matter. As papers throughout the country would report, Peterson had good cause to congratulate himself on his narrow escape. As recently as the week before the fire, Bell Ganesh was still trolling for victims. 17. The Graveyard. The road leading to the Ganesh place was so choked with buggies, buckboards, and bicycles on the morning of Wednesday, May 6th, that Sheriff Smutzer had trouble maneuvering his own vehicle through the traffic as he drove up to the farm. A massive crowd of men, women, and children, whose number that day would eventually swell to the thousands, was pressed against the wire mesh fence surrounding the hog lot, eager for a glimpse of the latest horrors. They didn't have long to wait. Smutzer, Joe Maxson, and a few other men recruited for the grim task began digging in the northeast corner of the lot, about 5 feet from the spot where the four decayed corpses had been found the day before. Almost immediately, their spades struck a patch of loose soil that gave off a nauseous smell. About 3 feet down, they turned up the butchered bones of another victim. Rotting burlap, the remains of the sack in which the torso had been stuffed, clung to the ribcage, pelvis, and spine. The skull, which bore a 3-inch gash, as if made by some cutting instrument, lay nearby, along with the sawed-off leg bones. The stink of the corpse was made even worse by the grave in which it lay, the body parts having been dumped into an abandoned privy vault. The ghoulish work did not deter Smutzer and his team from taking a break for their lunch. They resumed their digging about 30 minutes later. Just a few feet from the excavated latrine, their shovels uncovered more than a dozen pairs of men's shoes. Under the shoes lay a heap of human bones. One of the men dug into the pile, and his spade brought out parts of the legs of 2 bodies, one Chicago newspaper reported. A second spade full of dirt and bones revealed the fact that 3 bodies were hidden in the hole. All of the bodies were wrapped in gunny sacks. Quicklime had been placed in the sacks, but it had been poorly applied to the bodies. Many pieces of flesh clung to the bones where the lime had not eaten. As the leg bones were drawn out, the marks on them revealed for the first time the horrible, insane anger with which the woman worked over her victims. About the joints, she had hacked them with an axe. The bones had been crushed on the ends, as though they had been struck with hammers after they were dismembered. Two of the skulls were near each other. They had been buried face up. Quicklime had been scattered over the faces and stuffed in the ears. In one of the heads, a sufficient quantity had not been placed, and the brain remained intact. The lower parts of the bodies were decomposed, and it was impossible to tell whether they were men or women. The noisome relics were placed in tin pails and transferred to the buggy shed serving as a temporary morgue, from which, as one reporter observed, there proceeded a stench that daunts even the most resolute curiosity seeker. Added to the five bodies dug up the previous day, the latest discoveries brought the total of butchered corpses buried in Mrs. Ganesh's hog lot to nine. Across the country, from the New York Times to the San Francisco Chronicle, newspapers trumpeted the latest ghastly findings, branding Belle with a variety of lurid nicknames. A modern Lady Macbeth who poured blood into her coffers and turned it into gold. The LaPorte Ghoul, the Indiana Ogress, the Human Vampire, the Female Bluebeard, the High Priestess of Murder, the Mistress of the Castle of Death, the Queen of Crime, and Hell's Princess. In the view of the Pittsburgh Press, the murders in the Rue Morgue pale into insignificance when compared to this case, while a writer for the Chicago Evening American opined that if Poe were to come back to life, he might write a new and more thrilling story of the fall of the House of Usher. Mrs. Belle Ganesh, the grim widow of LaPorte, Indiana, with her castle of death and her yard filled with graves, would afford him material for a new, weird tale, more thrilling than any he conceived. Given a variety of factors, the proximity of LaPorte to Chicago, Belle's former residence in that city, and the shameless sensationalism of its yellow press, it was hardly surprising that the Chicago papers had a field day with the story. The Wednesday edition of William Randolph Hearst's Examiner made an especially startling claim. "Belle Ganesh, a member of Band of Chicago Thugs," the headline blared. "Police seeking her here." According to Assistant Police Chief Herman F. Schutler, Chicago was home to a gang of murderers organized for the purpose of collecting insurance on their victims. Mrs. Ganesh, he asserted, was a member of this gang of murderers, who received the bodies of the victims done to death in Chicago and disposed of them in her LaPorte home. Schutler's theory was largely based on the testimony of several local liverymen, who revealed that in 1906 and 1907, they had delivered at least nine heavy trunks to the Ganesh farm. It was the belief of the Chicago police, the newspaper declared, that this and the other trunks contained human bodies. One of these liverymen, Claude Sturgis, offered a dramatic account of his own experience in the fall of 1907. After carting a large, tightly corded trunk up on the porch of the Ganesh farmhouse and rolling it into the front parlor, he had begun to remove the ropes. At that instant, Mrs. Ganesh had rushed madly at him and asked what he was doing. "I always untie the trunks for the ladies," Sturgis replied. In a fit of rage, she grabbed him by the arm and, pushing him out the front door, told him to mind his own business. Receiving a tip that two mysterious trunks were currently awaiting shipment to the Ganesh farm, Captain O'Brien of the Chicago City Detective Bureau immediately instituted a search of all railroad baggage rooms and local express companies. According to the informant who contacted the police, the trunks contained the corpses of murder victims. Picking up on this story, newspapers throughout the country declared that Mrs. Ganesh was part of what was variously described as a crime bureau, criminal conspiracy, murder syndicate, and man-killing trust. Her role was that of fence or clearinghouse for this sinister organization, which used her farm as a graveyard for its victims. Stories began to circulate of a secret death chamber in Belle's House of Horrors that had served a ghastly function in this diabolical racket. "There was a room of the Ganesh home that was used exclusively by the woman," one paper reported. "No one was allowed to enter there, not even her children. The door was a heavy oaken affair, and the windows were tightly shaded. It was in this room the bodies were stored after they were shipped from Chicago. The woman piled them in there until they were old enough so there was no danger of their bleeding. Then she hacked them to pieces." Dr. J. H. William Meyer, former member of the Cook County Hospital staff, and president of the Alumni Association of Rush Medical College, suggested a somewhat different possibility. After taking part in the post-mortem examinations of several of the unearthed corpses, including the one identified as Andrew Helgelein, Meyer declared to reporters that the decapitation and severance of limbs from the bodies was done by an anatomical expert, someone familiar with the dissecting room. The disarticulation of the ball and socket joints of the shoulder, Meyer explained, was especially telling. This cannot be done by an amateur with an ordinary instrument, he insisted. Every one of these operations was clean cut. It was done by a strong hand with nothing less sharp than a surgeon's knife. The clear implication was that the victims had been dismembered in Chicago by a killer with medical expertise, then shipped in pieces to LaPorte. With the memory of Dr. H.H. Holmes still fresh in their minds, the infamous serial killer, who had purportedly dispatched and dissected an indeterminate number of victims in the dungeon of his so-called horror castle, Chicagoans could easily believe in the existence of a medical monster involved in a murder-for-profit scheme. The notion that Bell had accomplices in Chicago also lent credence to the widespread conviction that she was still alive, particularly after an unnamed witness came forward to say that he had spotted a cloaked figure boarding the Chicago train from LaPorte on the morning of April 28th, the day of the fire at the Ganesse farmhouse. Based on this intelligence, Schuettler speculated that Bell had been met in Chicago by a Confederate and was now hiding while awaiting a chance to escape to Norway. A massive search was launched for the arch murderess. Every depot in Chicago is being watched by the police, the examiner reported. The post office is under the eye of the police. So are numerous other places at which it might be supposed that the woman would appear. Express warehouses and baggage rooms are being winnowed for traces of trunks to or from the woman. A dragnet is out that encompasses the city. While police conducted their manhunt for the supposed fugitive, reporters tracked down Dr. J.C. Miller, who had been called to the bedside of the stricken Mats Sorensen 8 years earlier. Recent developments had compelled Dr. Miller to re-evaluate his original diagnosis. "When I arrived at Sorensen's home," Miller told the newsman, "he was clutching the bedpost and was in great agony. He died within half an hour. Sorensen was apparently in the best of health before he died. At the time, I believe that his death was probably due to hemorrhage of the brain. As I think of it now, however, I can see that the symptoms may have been those of strychnine poisoning." Convinced of Bell's connection to an organized gang of trunk murderers dated back to her days in Chicago, Assistant Chief Schuettler ordered an immediate investigation into the records of all missing persons who had disappeared from the Austin area at the time she lived there. Meeting with reporters late Wednesday, he also announced that, at sunrise the following day, his men would begin to spade up the backyard of the home she and Mads had shared on Alma Street. "We confidently expect to find bodies in this yard," Schuettler told the newspapermen. Moreover, he had reason to believe that not all of those bodies were those of adults. In addition to her other monstrous activities, Belle Ganesse, according to Schuettler, was in the business of baby farming. In the late 19th and early 20th century, mothers of unwanted infants, typically unwed women, prostitutes, or destitute females already overburdened with children, would consign the luckless newborns to paid caregivers who, for a flat or monthly fee, would agree to provide a home for the babies or find them suitable families for adoption. While some of these so-called baby farmers treated their charges with warm maternal care, a sizable number proved to be utterly callous females who sought to maximize their profits by supplying the children with the barest of necessities. When a social worker named Arthur Allen Guild conducted an investigation into Chicago's baby farms for the Juvenile Protection Agency, he found hundreds of diseased, malnourished children living in appalling conditions. So high was the mortality rate among these unregulated operations that, to many observers, they were little more than death traps. Some of the women involved in this sordid business, moreover, were guilty of far worse than criminal neglect. Perhaps the most notorious was the British baby farmer Amelia Dyer, believed to have murdered several hundred infants in her care. Chicago authorities were now firmly convinced that Mrs. Ganesse had engaged in the same gruesome business, taking in babies for a sum of money until they could be conveniently put out of the way. While they did not believe she had matched Amelia Dyer's record, they thought it likely that, as Lieutenant Matthew Zimmer of the Austin Police Station told reporters, she may have murdered children by the score. Indeed, said Zimmer, it was her success in hiding her crimes with the bodies of children that may have encouraged her to continue her crimes along bigger lines. The awful career of the LaPorte ghoul, Zimmer speculated, had begun by murdering babies. In LaPorte, authorities waved off the theories of the Chicago police. Informed of Schuettler's belief that the bodies dug up on Mrs. Ganesse's farm had been shipped there by her cohorts in a Chicago crime syndicate, LaPorte Mayor Lemuel Darrow was emphatic in his response. "There is only one solution to the mystery," he declared to reporters. "Mrs. Ganesse enticed all these people here for the purpose of getting their money and then murdered them. She carried on a correspondence with countrymen of hers when she knew they were single men or widowers with money," Darrow continued. "And after making offers of marriage or other inducements, such as having a suitable farm for sale, she would request a visit. After she got her men to the farm, she would entertain them so hospitably that their visits were prolonged. When the time was opportune, she would administer some kind of poison, probably arsenic or chloroform, and when death resulted, take her time in dismembering them and burying the remains in the yard. I believe she has been carrying on this extraordinary means of securing for several years," said Darrow, as the newspapermen scribbled his words in their notepads. "I believe further investigation will reveal more bodies of the woman's inhuman traffic." Asked by one of the reporters how many more bodies he expected to find, Darrow replied without hesitation. "I would not be surprised," he said, "to have a list of victims reach a score of men, women, and children." 18. Budsburg. A drenching rain on Thursday, May 7th, put the digging on hold. With the grim work suspended, Sheriff Smutzer traveled to Chicago early that morning to confer with his counterparts. He was still away when a messenger arrived at the jail to inform Deputy Antis that a pair of men had broken into the locked buggy shed on the Ganesse farm, where the exhumed piles of rotted flesh and bone lay on wooden planks. Hurrying out to the farm, Antis was met by Joe Maxson, who told him that while walking in the yard, he had spotted the two men climbing out of the shed's rear window. "One was a tall man with dark hair, and other was heavy-set, not quite so tall," said Maxson. "It was raining heavily, and I could not see much of their faces because their hats were pulled down low and their coat collars were up. I told them that the sheriff's orders forbade anybody entering the shed, and one of them said, 'Mind your own affairs. We're doctors and have a right to go in.'" Maxson immediately sent one of the neighbor boys into town to notify Antis. By then, however, the two men had already gotten away, hightailing it through the woods to a rig they had left nearby. Rumors quickly spread through town that accomplices of Mrs. Ganesse had smashed the lock of the shed and broken in to destroy evidence against her. They stole several bottles said to contain poison and attempted to mix up the bones of the skeletons to prevent identification. The truth turned out to be more mundane. The two men, later identified as residents of Michigan City, had snuck in through the window of the temporary morgue for no more sinister reason than to satisfy their morbid curiosity with a close-up look at the charnel remains of Mrs. Ganesse's victims. At around 1:30 that afternoon, before Smutzer's return, two young men arrived by train from Iola, Wisconsin, in the company of an older acquaintance, a hardware dealer named Edwin Chapin. They were met at the depot by James Buck, president of the LaPorte Savings Bank, who escorted them to the courthouse, where Deputy Antis took charge of them. The two young men were brothers Matthias and Oscar Budsburg, ages 27 and 29, respectively. Simple, ingenuous young farmers, as one newspaper patronizingly reported, slow of thought and utterance. They were there on a somber mission, to view a human skull thought to be that of their father, Ole Budsburg. 14 months earlier, Budsburg, a 51-year-old widower and subscriber to both the Skandinavien and the Decorah Posten, informed his sons that he was taking a trip to LaPorte, Indiana, to see about managing a farm there. To his brother, Buzzburg told a different story, that he was going there to marry a wealthy widow. He left Iola in the third week of March 1907, returning a week later to settle his affairs before moving permanently to his new home. He sold his farm to Matthias for $1,000. On April 5th, with the cash from the sale plus a mortgage note for an additional $1,000, secured by some land that he owned, he departed by train, promising his sons that he would write as soon as he was settled. The following day, as a cashier named J.W. Crumpacker later testified, Budsberg appeared at the First National Bank of La Porte in the company of Belle Gonesse and requested that his mortgage note be sent to the Farmers' State Bank in Iola for collection. He was back with Mrs. Gonesse on April 16th to pick up the money. "That was the last time I saw him alive," Crumpacker would say. By late April, having received no word from their father, Matthias was sufficiently concerned to send him a letter at the Gonesse farm. It was eventually returned as undeliverable by the dead letter office in Washington, D.C. In the meantime, the mortgage note having come due, J.C. Swenson, a cashier at the Farmers State Bank in Iola, sent a letter of inquiry to cashier Crumpacker, asking as to whether he had seen anything of Mr. Budsberg lately. Crumpacker passed along the letter to his employer, Bank President Buck, who took it upon himself to drive out to the Gonesse farm and see if Budsberg was there. At his knock, Mrs. Gonesse came to the door but did not invite him inside. To his question about Budsberg, she replied that she did not know where he was. During a visit to Chicago, she explained, he had been robbed of most of his money. When he got back to La Porte, he decided that he would go out west and try to make up what he had been robbed of before any of his relatives should learn of it. A few days later, she could not remember the date, she had taken him to the train depot where he set out on a trip to Oregon. That was the last she had seen of him. Buck had Crumpacker notify the bank officers in Iola. Several months later, following the conflagration at the Gonesse farm and the discovery of the first bodies in the hog lot, Crumpacker sent newspaper clippings to cashier Swenson, who notified the Budsberg brothers. Fearing the worst, Matthias and Oscar had set out at once for La Porte. At around 2 p.m., Deputy Antis drove the Budsberg brothers out to the Gonesse farm. Despite the inclement weather, 20 or so men, drawn by the fast-spreading stories of the supposedly sinister break-in that had taken place earlier in the day, were gathered outside the buggy shed. Antis led his two charges into the foul-smelling outbuilding, the other men crowding in eagerly behind them. By the glow of an oil lamp, Matt and Oscar peered at the row of planks holding the rank remains dug out of the barnyard. Atop one mass of decayed bones and skin sat the skull they had come to view, and they bent to take a closer look. Though the head retained few recognizable features, there was no mistaking its distinctive facial hair. A tangled red waterfall mustache, as one historian describes it, curling into the fleshless mouth. After a moment, the brothers straightened up, exchanged a grim look, then pushed their way out of the shed and into the open air. Withdrawing a ways, they engaged in a brief whispered conversation before returning to the shed. By then, Antis had emerged and stood waiting for them. "It's him," said Matt. "I'm sure of it."
"It's what we feared," said Oscar.
The Budsberg boys had found their father. In a front-page story datelined May 7th, the New York Times summed up for its readers the four main theories surrounding the Gonesse case, a series of crimes which have startled the whole country. Theory number one, that Mrs. Gonesse, fearing exposure of her long murderous career, killed her three children and herself, setting fire to the house to conceal the crimes. Theory number two, that Mrs. Gonesse, fearing exposure, fled after killing her children, putting the headless body of another woman in the house to mislead authorities. Theory number three, that Ray Lamphere, her farmhand, did the killing from a double motive of revenge and jealousy. Theory number four, that the quadruple crime was committed by a murderous gang with headquarters in Chicago who feared exposure by Mrs. Gonesse of a long series of murders for insurance, she being used as their clearinghouse for corpses. Even as this edition of the paper was going to press, however, authorities in Chicago were discounting the last of these theories.
Just one day after making his confident pronouncements about Mrs. Ganesh's involvement with a crime syndicate, Assistant Chief Schutler did a complete about-face on the issue. His reversal was prompted partly by a talk with Sheriff Smutzer, who gave no credence to the notion that the rotted remains exhumed from Bell's barnyard had been shipped there from Chicago. Investigators had also determined that the information about the two mysterious trunks supposedly awaiting delivery to the death farm was a false lead, if not an outright hoax. I no longer believe that Mrs. Ganesh was the agent of a gang of murderers or that she ran a baby farm, he told reporters. It appears certain that she herself killed the suitors whose bodies were found in the farmyard graves. That she could have lured and killed more than a dozen men in this way is entirely plausible. I believe she answered letters from men of her own nationality and invited them to her farm. There she showed them the abundant fields. The prospect was pleasing. So much accomplished, the rest was not so difficult as might be supposed. A little chloral in a glass of beer or coffee brings quick death. So does a well-directed blow with a hammer or hatchet. There is no reason why she, a strong woman, could not have buried them as well. Her farm is far from the nearest neighbor. At the same time, Schutler clung to his conviction that the arch-murderess was still alive. I cannot believe that she is dead. She was too expert a criminal to be caught that way. She may well be in Chicago. His opinion seemed to be confirmed by an acquaintance of Bell's, who notified the police that he had seen her board a North Clark streetcar at Summerdale Avenue just one day earlier, Wednesday the 6th. Several other witnesses claimed to have encountered her in the vicinity of Wabash Avenue District, south of the Loop, within the past week. One of these was a pharmacist named Al Levi, proprietor of a drugstore in the Commercial Hotel building on Wabash Avenue and Harrison Street. After coming upon a photograph of Bell in the Chicago Tribune, Levi contacted the newspaper, claiming to recognize her as the same woman who attempted to buy morphine from him within 4 or 5 days after the Ganesh House of Horror had been burned. "I am certain it is her," insisted Levi, who would not be the last to assert that he had come face to face with the living Bell Ganesh. "The features, the nose, the mouth, the eyes are the same." Persuaded now that Bell's atrocities had been confined to her remote farm in La Porte, Schutler called off plans to search for other missing persons in the yard of her former residence in Austin. His decision did not prevent a group of enterprising reporters from showing up with shovels on Alma Street. Before they could begin to dig, however, they were confronted by the current owners, brothers John and Daniel Nellis, a pair of burly plumbers from Wisconsin, who had purchased the premises in November 1907 and who threatened to get an injunction restraining any excavating here. "We bought this property," said Daniel, "and all this sensational talk is injuring it." Schutler's belief that Bell had staged her own death and made her way to Chicago was shared by LaPorte's mayor, Lemuel Darrow, and his police chief, Clinton Cochran. Sheriff Smutzer and Prosecutor Smith, on the other hand, were adamant that she had perished in the fire. Of course, as newspapers were quick to point out, Smutzer and Smith had good reason to insist on that point. To admit that she was still alive would, as the Chicago Tribune put it, destroy the case they are building against Ray Lamphere. On that same afternoon, Thursday, May 7th, Smith appeared before a flock of reporters to make a dramatic announcement. So far as the state was concerned, the case against Lamphere was complete. Mrs. Ganesh's former handyman and lover would be indicted and tried not only for arson, but for murder. "I am satisfied we have collected testimony of such a character that Lamphere's responsibility for the deaths in the house will be established beyond all reasonable doubt," Smith declared. "We will produce witnesses to prove that Lamphere was seen around the Ganesh house before the fire broke out and that he was seen running away later. We shall also prove that he set fire to the place in revenge for action taken against him by the woman after they had fallen out, and that this disagreement was due to a quarrel over the murder of Helgeline in which Lamphere was implicated, according to our evidence." Asked by one newspaper man if, as was widely reported, police had resorted to the third degree, sweating, to extract information from Lamphere, Smith bristled. "We don't sweat people here," he said. "La Porte is a civilized town. We're not like Chicago and New York." He concluded that he would endeavor to have the case called for trial at the next term of court. Lampier, Smith predicted, will be on trial within 3 weeks. 19. The Web. Reporting on State Attorney Smith's announcement, Friday's Chicago Tribune ran a story headlined, Weave Web Around Lampier. A web of a very different kind appeared prominently in the same issue, a front-page editorial cartoon depicting a swarm of insect-winged men, satchels in hand, flying into the clutches of a fat female spider. Blazoned across the spider's back were the words, Matrimonial Bureau. According to one informed estimate, Chicago in the first decade of the 20th century was home to no fewer than 125 matrimonial or affinity agencies, the vast bulk of them fly-by-night operations designed to milk as much cash as possible from desperately lonely men and women. Typical was the scam conducted by a woman named E.L. Glynn, who snared victims by running phony newspaper advertisements ostensibly placed by prosperous businessmen and well-to-do widows in search of congenial mates. The dupes who responded to these come-ons were required to mail Miss Glynn a $5 initiation fee in her matchmaking club, in return for which they would receive more detailed information about the non-existent marriage seekers, along with a list of other possible and equally fictitious candidates. Before she was arrested, tried, and convicted of mail fraud, Glynn managed to rope in more than 600 suckers of both sexes, none of whom, it seems needless to say, ended up with a husband or wife. Decrying Glynn and her ilk as a menace to the American people, who debased the ideal of love and marriage by reducing it to a matter of tawdry commercialism, Chicago authorities went after the worst of the offenders. One larger-than-life character, Detective Sergeant Clifton R. Wooldridge, the self-styled American Sherlock Holmes, responsible for 20,000 arrests during his two-decade career, waged relentless war on these con artists, regarding their chicanery as one of the most insidious forms of crime, a volcano belching forth fraud, swindling, bigamy, and desertion. In his best-selling memoir, 20 Years a Detective in the Wickedest City in the World, Wooldridge proudly proclaims that he had put more than 100 of these get-rich-quick schemers out of business, seizing and destroying 40 wagon loads of their meretricious circulars and advertisements. The battle against Chicago's love brokers turned into an all-out crusade in the wake of the Gonesse revelations. Conveniently ignoring the fact that Bell had never availed herself of a matrimonial agency, the district attorney's office issued immediate instructions that every manager of an affinity bureau in the Chicago district be placed under immediate arrest. The revelations in LaPorte have been such, Assistant D.A. Seward S. Shirer told reporters, that we believe different alleged matcher-up bureaus have sent men and women to murder establishments like the one run by Mrs. Gonesse. This was probably done to rob them of the few cents they may have had in their pockets. These poor persons are an unintellectual set, and could be murdered and put out of the way without much danger of exposure. While conceding that not all matrimonial agencies were in the business of wholesale murder, he insisted that there was no telling how far each manager will go in his efforts to wring a few pennies out of the poor persons who answer their alluring advertisements. Detective Wooldridge's memoir echoed these sentiments. Switching from a geological metaphor, the belching volcano, to a botanical one, he described the matrimonial bureau as a plant of hell whose most hideous blossom was the Gonesse murder farm. This wholesale murderess, Wooldridge proclaimed in defiance of the facts, lured her victims to their fate through advertisements in a matrimonial paper or through a matrimonial agency. Through the aid of these fraudulent agencies, this woman murdered more people than any other human being who ever lived. Accompanying this passage was an illustration of a scythe-wielding Belle standing in her yard at night. All about her were graves sprouting skull-flowered plants. The Death Harvester, read the caption. This, then, is the crowning work of the matrimonial agency, Wooldridge concluded. This horrid, burying ground of dismembered bodies, this ghastly charnel pit on an Indiana hillside. By their fruits shall ye know them.
in the dread Ganesse farm, behold the ripened fruit of the matrimonial agency.
20. The Corpse Harvest. On Friday morning, May 8th, the flooding rain that had fallen for the past 36 hours subsided to an intermittent drizzle. At daylight, a great caravan of buggies, hacks, wagons, and assorted conveyances began making its way toward the horror farm. By 8 a.m., more than 1,000 men, women, and children, farmers, merchants, clerks, residents of adjacent towns and villages, had shown up to watch the grave hunting resume. Locating a soft spot not far from the pits they had excavated on Wednesday, Sheriff Smutzer, Joe Maxson, and Daniel Hudson bent to their task. The saturated soil came up easily under their spades. Just a half hour after digging began, Hudson struck something solid, a rotting wooden box, which disintegrated into splinters as he poked it with the blade of his tool. "As the fragments fell aside," one observer wrote, "they revealed a mass of lime, from which ragged pieces of gunny sack were lifted. In the bottom of the hole, a tangled heap of bones was exposed, to some of which masses of jelly-like flesh still clung. There was also a skull, with some strands of dark hair sticking to it." The bones were brought to the surface and examined by Coroner Mack. Like all of Bell's victims, this one had been carved up prior to disposal. The legs neatly sawed off 2 inches above the knee joints, the arms severed near the shoulders. From the size of the bones and the dimension of the skull, Mack concluded that the remains were those of an adult male, despite the incongruous fact that 2 pairs of women's shoes had been tossed into the pit with the body. As word of the find spread through the crowd, hundreds made a mad dash for the freshly opened grave. One newspaper man witnessed a scene that captured the frenzy of the moment. An old man with a long gray beard had just arrived at the farm, pulling 2 toddlers, evidently his grandchildren, in a little wooden wagon. As he approached the hog lot, the little wagon toppled over and the 2 children were thrown to the muddy ground. It was at this moment that the cry was raised, "Another body has been found," and the old man ran to the excavation, leaving the children crying on the ground. The mystery of the women's shoes was solved a few minutes later. Continuing to dig in the same hole, Hudson soon turned up another mass of bones. Because there was only 1 skull in the grave, Smutzer initially theorized that all the remains belonged to a single victim. Coroner Mack quickly disabused him of that notion. "If all those bones belonged to 1 person," Mack declared, "you'd have a monstrosity someone 10 or 12 feet high." To Mack's practiced eye, it was clear that this 2nd skeleton was that of a woman. Placed in separate tin buckets, the 2 butchered skeletons, the 10th and 11th to be dug out of the death garden, were transferred to the improvised morgue to join the other fetid remnants of Bell Ganesse's victims. As a result of the nationwide coverage of the case, police officials in La Porte were flooded with inquiries from people who feared that their long-missing loved ones had ended up in the muck of Bell Ganesse's hog lot. From Mrs. J. M. Canary of Pine Lakes, Indiana, came a letter about her 19-year-old son, Edward, a somewhat troubled, not intellectually bright youth who had once burned an empty cottage for the pleasure of seeing it being destroyed. Edward had disappeared abruptly from his job as a local farmhand in July 1906 and had not been seen since. William Stern, a Philadelphia saloonkeeper, wrote to ask about his 28-year-old employee, Charles Nyberg. A recent immigrant from Sweden, Nyberg, whose one ambition was to marry a woman of wealth and who spent all his free time answering matrimonial advertisements, had vanished in June 1906, telling his boss that he was going to Indiana to marry a widow with a large farm. He had left his bicycle and a trunk full of clothing behind, saying that he would send for them once he was married. But Stern had never heard from him. Another letter came from Mr. G.R. Burke of Tuscola, Illinois, asking about his former worker, George Bradley. The previous October, the 40-year-old Bradley had announced that he intended to marry a widow who owned a nice farm near La Porte. Selling about $1,500 worth of property, he had departed for Indiana, leaving his clothing with Mr. Burke and saying that he would come back for it, but he never returned. The wife of Benjamin Carling, an agent for the Prudential Life Insurance Company in Chicago, sent a pleading letter about her husband, who had left home for LaPorte a year before, telling her that he had secured a splendid investment through a rich widow. He was enthusiastic over the plan, having borrowed several thousand dollars from Chicago men whom he had interested in the scheme. At the same time, he had in his possession $1,000 belonging to an insurance company. That was the last anyone had seen of him. Mrs. Coolers of McKeesport, Pennsylvania, contacted Sheriff Smutzer about her missing father, John E. Hunter of Duquesne, who left his home in November 1907 for northern Indiana to marry a wealthy widow, as he informed his family. He took with him a large sum of money, telling his daughter he did not know when he would return. Gustav Thunes, a resident of Washington, Pennsylvania, likewise told his family and friends that he had been in communication with a wealthy widow in LaPorte. According to a letter sent by his former employer, Pat Schimmick, the last anyone had seen of Thunes was when he started for the Indiana town last summer with $1,000. And there were letters and telegrams concerning dozens of other vanished men. Herman Konitzer of Chicago, Auguste Gunderson of Green Lake, Wisconsin, Lindner Nicholson of Huron, South Dakota, Andrew Anderson of Lawrence, Kansas, E.F. Plato of Youngstown, Ohio, I.T. Stryver of North Bend, Nebraska, Bert Chase of Mishawaka, Indiana, Emil Tell of Kansas City, Missouri, George Williams of Wapwallopin, Pennsylvania, and more. The physical descriptions that generally accompanied these inquiries were, for the most part, utterly useless. Given the condition of the exhumed bodies, piles of hacked, rotting skeletons with an occasional fleshless skull, it was impossible to put names to most of them. Circumstantial evidence, however, left little doubt as to some of their identities. From the testimony of various witnesses, authorities concluded that Bell's hired hands, Olaf Lindboy and Henry Gerholt, who had both disappeared under highly suspicious circumstances, were two of her earliest victims. Another man named Olaf Jensen, had written to relatives in Norway that he was leaving his home in Carroll, Indiana, to marry a rich widow who owned a farm in LaPorte. Jensen had been seen on the Ganesse place, helping Bell with some chores. He disappeared shortly after cashing a large check at the First National Bank of LaPorte. When neighbors asked of his whereabouts, Bell claimed that he had gone west because he didn't like LaPorte. Arthur Peglow, an assistant cashier at the First National Bank, was able to identify another victim who had been lured into Bell's clutches. This was 40-year-old bachelor John Moe, resident of Elbow Lake, Minnesota, and subscriber to the Skandinavien, who arrived in LaPorte after informing relatives that he was moving to a town in Indiana not far from Chicago. In December 1906, Moe had come into the bank to cash two checks totaling $1,000. He was never seen again. Peglow clearly remembered Moe when he was shown a photograph. In early 1906, 55-year-old Christian Hilkvin of Dover, Wisconsin, had abruptly departed after selling his farm for $2,000 in cash. His fate was established by Johannes B. Vist, editor of the Norwegian-language newspaper The Decoro Posten. After reading of the Ganesse atrocities, Vist notified authorities that, in the spring of 1906, he had received a letter from Hilkvin, a longtime subscriber, asking that future issues be mailed to him in LaPorte. The LaPorte postmaster confirmed that Hilkvin's mail was delivered to Mrs. Ganesse's farm. As is typically the case when a community discovers that a homicidal monster has been living in its midst, people immediately came forward with breathless tales of narrow escapes. Some of these were clearly the products of overheated imaginations. 18-year-old Harriet Danielson of Austin, for example, one of Jenny Olsen's former playmates, reported that the previous September, she had been invited to spend a week with her childhood friend at LaPorte. "She told me what a beautiful home they had down there, and what a delightful time we could have together," Harriet explained. "She said her mother urged me to come. It was just an accident that I did not go. A friend of mine did not want me to. There was some pretext or reason I could not go at the time. I wrote Jenny saying I could not visit her at that time. I got no reply. Had I gone down there, I am firmly convinced the woman would have murdered me," Harriet asserted. "I know the only reason she consented to Jenny inviting me down there was with the hope of killing us both. The thought of it, chopping my head open and sawing my arms off, has made me sick. A young man named Melvin Kanaga garnered a fair amount of publicity for himself with a story that, for all its wild improbability, was widely reported as fact. According to Kanaga, a resident of Elkhart, Indiana, he and his friend Delbert Landers had been riding the train home from work the previous August when a strange woman entered the car and seated herself beside them. She began talking to Delbert in a friendly way and relating how lonesome it was out there, Kanaga recounted. Then she pretended as though she liked him very much. She told him she was single and had a nice farm just a short distance from LaPorte. Finally, in a roundabout way, she suggested that Delbert pay her a visit, as she was wealthy and would be more than pleased to show him a good time. Then she asked him to come and make his home with her, that they could live peacefully and well-contented. He spoke to her of me, at which she turned to me and told me she would be glad to have me come also. The woman disembarked at LaPorte, and Kanaga had never given her a second thought until the news broke of the Ganess death farm. Had Kanaga complied with the requests of the woman, who no doubt was none other than Mrs. Ganess, the papers reported, it is probable that he would have been lured into the clutches to suffer the same penalty as did many other victims. No doubt her intentions were to get him to her home, induce him to get an insurance policy, and take his life. That Belle lusted after Harriet Danielson's blood, or made seductive advances to Melvin Kanaga and his friend, was exceedingly unlikely. Other individuals, however, had legitimate reasons for believing that, as the newspapers put it, they had escaped the clutches of the fiend. Besides Carl Peterson, the 36-year-old Wapaka, Wisconsin man rejected by Belle because he lacked $1,000, there was Alonzo Lon Townsend of Topeka, Kansas, a well-to-do farmer who had arranged to visit her home in early May but was delayed by late spring rains which prevented him from putting in his crops as soon as he had desired. By the time he was ready to make the trip, the Ganess home was ashes. Had she gone on with her career of crime a few days longer, Townsend would probably have perished by her hand, the Argus Bulletin observed. As it is now, he is so pleased over his escape from his prospective bride that he left Topeka on an early morning train for Kansas City so that he could best celebrate his fortunate escape. If Townsend had been spared by a fortuitous spell of bad weather, another bachelor farmer, Olaf W. Katchhausen of Opine, Illinois, attributed his salvation to a family emergency. After an increasingly ardent exchange of letters with Belle not long before the fire, Katchhausen had, in accordance with her wishes, withdrawn $2,000 from his bank and made plans to move to LaPorte. Just before his scheduled departure, however, he received a message to hurry to the home of his parents in Bishop, Illinois, and there he went. Had the message not come, the Opine man would have been one of the victims of the human slaughterhouse. George Anderson, a 39-year-old Missourian who had responded to one of Belle's ads in 1906, had an especially close call. Satisfied with his financial qualifications, she had instructed him to convert his property into cash and join her in LaPorte, where they would be married. On the night of his arrival, he repaired to his bedroom on the second floor of the farmhouse and quickly fell asleep. Sometime around midnight, stirred from his slumbers by a dream that something uncanny was hovering over him, he opened his eyes to find Mrs. Ganess standing over his bed. She spoke and then ran out of the room. Greatly frightened, he did not close his eyes after that, and at daylight left the place. In light of the recent horrific revelations, Anderson had no doubt that, as one newspaper put it, murder was in the heart of Mrs. Ganess when she entered the death chamber that night, and Anderson would have paid the penalty of her lust had he been asleep. But Providence watched over him, and he escaped decapitation, dismemberment, and burial in her private cemetery. Anderson was certain of something else, too. "I am convinced the woman is still alive," he told reporters, "and that she set fire to the farmhouse herself." Sightings of Belle continued to be reported in Chicago. She was spotted riding on streetcars, hurrying along the streets, eating in restaurants. May Wagner, a waitress at Bookbinder's Cafe on Van Buren Street, told police that at around 9 o'clock on the morning of May 8th, a woman precisely matching Mrs. Ganess's description entered, with a man, the couple having alighted from the Rock Island train a few minutes earlier. The man ordered 2 steaks, and Miss Wagner, who took the order, handed them a newspaper containing the latest details of the LaPorte tragedy, with a portrait of Mrs. Ganesse on the open page. The man, said the waitress, took one look at the paper, threw it on the floor, and then he and the woman left hurriedly before they'd taken more than a bite of steak and a sip of coffee. She wanted to know if there was anything wrong with the food, and the man told her no, he wasn't feeling well. About an hour later, the same couple was seen eating a hurried breakfast at Heibel's restaurant on West Jackson Boulevard and Halsted Street, their furtive manner attracting the notice of the proprietor. As far as the Chicago Tribune was concerned, these and other eyewitness accounts left little doubt that the arch-murderess was at large in the city. Fleeing from place to place, haunted by her conscience, and in constant dread that she will be seized by the hands of the law, Belle Ganesse is being sought by scores of detectives, the paper informed its readers. It was one of the Tribune's competitors, however, the Chicago Inter-Ocean, that made the most dramatic claim about the issue. Its correspondent in LaPorte had somehow wangled his way into the embalming room of the Austin Cutler funeral home, where the charred remains removed from the cellar of the incinerated farmhouse had been brought. Before the mutilated trunk of the dead woman was sewn into its burial shroud, Cutler weighed and tape-measured it in the reporter's presence. Allowing for its missing head and feet, the undertaker calculated that, in life, the dead woman was 5 feet 2 inches in height and weighed about 130 pounds. By contrast, Mrs. Ganesse, according to her neighbors, stood 5 feet 7 inches tall and weighed around 280 pounds. There was only one conclusion to be drawn from this astounding revelation, the paper proclaimed. Mrs. Belle Ganesse, the siren who lured a score of men to their death, was, beyond a reasonable doubt, alive. 21. The Mind of Mrs. Ganesse. The members of the governing board of the Norwegian Lutheran Children's Home, West Irving Boulevard and 58th Avenue in Chicago, were faced with a quandary. They were in the midst of a drive to raise $25,000 for a new building in Norwood Park, and had just been named the beneficiary of a large, wholly unexpected gift. Unfortunately, it had been left to their institution by one of the most infamous killers in the annals of American crime, who had evidently acquired much, if not all of it, from her many victims. The Reverend C. E. Solberg, president of the board, was in Minnesota on church-related business when the terms of Bell's will were made public, and immediately arranged to return to Chicago to confer with his colleagues. Even before he arrived, however, Miss Caroline Williams, superintendent of the children's home, announced that the orphanage had no intention of accepting Belle Ganesse's blood money. Since the precise number of Belle's victims would never be known, it is impossible to say exactly how much money she realized from her butcheries. One widely syndicated article headlined, "Small Fortune for Indiana Murderess," added together the insurance payouts from the deaths of her 2 husbands with the amount she is believed to have received from the inmates of her charnel house, and arrived at the figure of $46,900, the equivalent in today's dollars, of over $1,200,000. Though the money-mad Mrs. Ganesse clearly killed for financial gain, greed alone could not account for the sheer savagery of her crimes, the evident gusto with which she slaughtered her victims like farm animals. Various specialists in the human mind were promptly called upon to offer their analyses of Belle's bizarre mentality. In the view of one prominent alienist, she was a woman of dual personality, a kind and indulgent mother at certain times, and at others a demon without fear of God, of man, or of the law. Another diagnosed her as a victim of an uncontrollable passion for taking lives, a mania for murdering. Dr. Hugo Munsterberg, professor of psychology at Harvard University, and author of the book On the Witness Stand, Essays on Psychology and Crime, saw in Belle a total absence of empathy, characteristic of the criminal type soon to be known as a psychopath. The scientific investigator, in seeking an explanation for Mrs. Ganesse's unnatural crimes, would say that she was emotionally dead, Munsterberg wrote. When once the emotions that make most women so sensitive to any cruelty are deadened, then the path is opened for carrying crime to any extent. When the emotions are dead, a woman is not affected by any of the natural feminine feelings of horror, fright at the sight of blood, or pity that ordinarily influence a normal person. Because her emotions were dead, she could carve a body to pieces, gather up all the piteous dismembered parts,